All I see is the day in front of us.
All I see is the day in front of us.
Burning bright with a newborn sun. Come follow me. Hills to climb and valleys to roam. Oh, streams to follow on the way.
Episode of, I guess, this impromptu reunion, not even reunion, this one-off episode of Nerds on the Rocks. I mean, everybody else is doing a podcast. I might as well reuse the one that I've done for almost a decade now, branding, and I have the website name. But I come to you today not to revisit the past. Well, I guess in a way, yes. You know, as we've been knocked down in quarantine for the past nearly 5 months here in the States, I've done a lot of different projects, I'm sure everybody has. They've picked up interests and hobbies, and they binged their favorite movies and TV shows. I, for some odd reason, decided to take it to the other extreme, and my mind wandered and raced as I debated with folks, like, how many people had seen the entire The Land Before Time series before? Like, how many films had people seen? How many films were people aware of? Like, even myself had a vague understanding of how many movies actually existed in this franchise. And for some odd reason, I got it in my head that I need to see them all. I need to kind of understand the history of The Land Before Time. And I did so. Over the past 2 weeks, I spent my working hours working, but also playing The Land Before Time franchise in the background. So that means for the past 2 weeks, I've watched 14 movies, and I spent approximately 1,050 minutes watching the adventures of Littlefoot and Petrie and Sari and Ducky and their friends as they ventured through The Land Before Time, as they had adventures in the Great Valley. And I can't tell you what type of person I came out on the other end of that. I don't know if I'm a better person for doing it or a worse person for having experienced it. But I figured I did this experiment. I watched 14 Land Before Time movies, that I needed some type of recollection, some type of memory or write-up of what I watched. And I figured it would just be easier to voice my thoughts and opinions on this. And I will apologize in advance. A lot of this is just stream of thoughts. A lot of this is just stuff that will pop into my head as we talk about it. So, I mean, as a whole, this is not going to be a 3-hour show. I'm not going to break down all 14 movies. I will tell you at some point, they all do start to grow together. And not necessarily because I watch them all back to back. In the back half of the franchise, I would say around like movie 6 or 7, they start converting it. I mean, and maybe even earlier, there's really only two types of Land Before Time movies later on. That is one where something happens in the Great Valley and the kids need to figure it out before something more drastic happens. So it might be the first, snowfall of the Great Valley. It might be that the water's drying up in the Great Valley. The other main plot is that something external happens and the kids have to venture to the mysterious beyond, and they go on some adventure, and the parents or the parental figures get worried. It gets resolved and the kids come back. Like that, you can pretty much divide up most of the Land Before Time movies into those categories. But I'm not going to break them all down, like I said, but let's start with the first one. The first one, I think, is a lot of people are familiar with. That's the one I knew. And it honestly speaking, is the black sheep of the franchise in so many ways. Partially because of its tone. It is a much darker, it is a much more, emotionally driven movie. But really what surprised me, and what you will find once you get beyond the first one, is it's the only movie in the franchise that isn't a musical. There is no musical number in the first one, which makes sense, but every subsequent movie after that does have musical numbers, and that threw me for a massive loop when I started the second movie, and within like 5 or 10 minutes there was a musical number, and I knew that the shift had occurred, that The Land Before Time that I knew and grew up with was a different beast than what came after it. The other thing, and again, you might not know, maybe you knew there were 14 movies, is that there's a huge gap between the first movie and the second movie. There is a 6-year gap. The first one came out in 1989, 88, and the second one came out in 1994, I want to say. So there is a decent gap between those movies, and then almost every sequel after that is roughly on a, like, there's periods of times where there might be a 2 or 3 years gap in between movies, but most of them from 2 to 13 have roughly a 1 year gap between them. And then there's a gap between 13 and 14, and right now there's nothing in the pipes past 14. I heard rumors of a CG TV show. We'll see what comes of that. But yes, going back to the first one. The first one, like I said, also does not fit into the plot of the rest of the movies, because it is, if you've seen it and you know about it, it is actually them venturing from their home territory to get to this great valley, to get to this place that Littlefoot's mom told him about. So that is them. I mean, I guess it can fall into the category of them venturing out of the great valley and having to find, resolve something. But the great valley is the ultimate destination. It is them coming to seek a safe passage through this territory. And what really drives it is that it is driven by these little kids trying to get back together with their parents. And that is, you know, it's a very compelling story. It's one that really works. The art style, and, you know, if you know the first one, Steven Spielberg and Don Bluth are involved with that. And that would also be a relationship and dynamic that does not continue on throughout the rest of the series. Which also means that the animation quality of the original is much higher. But one of the things I was most surprised by is actually the animation quality of Vader Frames doesn't really take a knock. I do think it holds up really remarkably well. That said, like I said, it is a standout of the franchise, and as we get into the second one, it turns into musical numbers. Now, this is where the second and third one confused me, because I thought they were going in one direction, which they kind of dropped later on. I think the second, third, and maybe the fourth one actually introduce villains of the movies, which are characters who speak and have personality, unlike Sharptooth, who is just like this big scary threat. They are characters with ambitions and goals that the Littlefoot and gang have to deal with and kind of best and sometimes get the better of. And I was really ready to see the movie franchise develop these villain characters over the course of the franchise. But like I said, they kind of disappear. Like, I don't really know what happened to them. Like, they're different in each of the movies, but again, I thought it was interesting that they were going with these unique characters as antagonists for our heroes. And then pretty much after that, it kind of goes into the realm I spoke about earlier, which is more to do with their dynamic, whether in or outside of the Great Valley. That said, I think the villains in these movies weren't that great, but I thought it was an interesting idea and an interesting hook, because there's only so much you can do with the Sharptooth, or at least I thought there was, because, again, it's more of a physical threat. It doesn't speak, it's just anger. And really, I think it uses a bit of a suster when it does not kill any of the characters. So once they defeated the first one, I'm like, okay, you kind of put that on the back burner. But I will tell you this much, Sharptooth returns a lot. I mean, almost every movie after these ends in some fashion with the Sharptooth showing up near the climax, even if for a moment. It may not be the ultimate obstacle they need to overcome, but it tends to show up. And it gets to one of the interesting aspects of the movies. One of the ones I honestly was not expecting was that the movies kept up really with the science of the time in regard to dinosaur. So the Sharptooth in the original movie is a T-Rex. And it's mostly a T-Rex for a lot of its runtime. But as the franchise goes on, they also introduce I believe a Spinosaurus and a Dinosaurus as a Sharptooth. Because, again, research has come out that the T-Rex wasn't necessarily the scariest or the most dangerous dinosaur that existed. So the movies tried to reflect that. And what was most interesting is by the time we got to the 14th movie, they also introduced dinosaurs that had hair or feathers, which, again, wasn't present or really known within the first movie, or the first 13, I guess. But when that became knowledgeable, they included it in the franchise. So I think it's a great way to kind of like pay respect to the science and research that is going on in the real world with this franchise, and seeing how it evolves with the times.
The other, I'm not going to slander it. I mean, I've not slandered this movie, these movies much at all. The other thing I was super surprised by is the fact that there is a good sense of continuity in these movies, in the sense that movies take place in the order that they're released, and characters and actions from previous movies will return in the way that they left off. So, for instance, in movie two, we're introduced to a character named Chomper, which is a baby T-Rex. As I mentioned before, the T-Rex are sharp-toothed, this big, threatening, villainous antagonist throughout most of the franchise, but Chomper is the first one that is introduced. It's an infant when Noodlefoot meets him, and Noodlefoot kind of becomes the surrogate mother for it. And they become friends. The sharp tooth Chomper learns how to speak. And at the end of the movie, they were threatened by Sharp Tooth, but the Sharp Tooth turned out to be Chomper's mother. Chomper went back with his mother. Peace was resolved. Cut to 6 or 7 movies later, Littlefoot, I should say, ends up in this area with T-Rex everywhere, and is about to be harmed when it turns out Chomper's there. Chomper's still a little kid because none of these characters really age beyond adolescence. But Chomper's there. Chomper remembers Littlefoot. Chomper remembers everything that Littlefoot has done for him, and all of Littlefoot friends, honestly. And so Chomper's trying to get them to, not only have his parents make peace with them, but also he's trying to get them to live in this area with him because he misses his friends. This gets into and I love that piece of continuity. And I was going to transition to something else, but I'll get to that later on. In the, I want to say, 9th or 10th movie, Littlefoot meets his dad, who at this point I honestly just assume he didn't have a dad because it had never been mentioned. We know his mom dies in the first movie, spoilers if you've not seen a 32-year-old movie at this point, and he lives with his grandparents. But yes, we find out that he has a dad, and we find out that there's a reason why his dad had never shown up. It's, he's not a deadbeat dad, he's not a walkabout. Is that what he heard about what happened with Littlefoot and his mom and the Great Divide, and he was on his way to go meet them, where he ran into other Yongnecks, and he helped those Yongnecks, and he ran into other Yongnecks. And essentially what happened is, over time, he became leader of this huge herd that he then had to protect and shepherd, and they had their own thing. So Littlefoot runs into him, and that becomes a big talking point. And at the end of the movie, Littlefoot decides to return to the Great Valley with his grandparents and his friends, with the promise that, his dad would come to visit every year or so. Cut to the 14th movie, the most recent one, and lo and behold, Littlefoot's dad is making his annual pilgrimage to the Great Valley when something happens. So the story goes that Littlefoot's out to go rescue him. But again, I have that sense of continuity. I have the sense that, for a children's movie that I honestly would assume is a cash grab, that it's not just like one-off movies with no real sense of continuity. It's just like, we will introduce something in movie two, we will pay it off in movie 10 for you. We'll introduce something in like movie 5, and you will get a recognition of it in movie 13, and it will make sense in the order of which you saw it. Because, like, honestly speaking, if I had not seen these movies back to back, I probably wouldn't care. But the fact that they do enough just shows me that there's a level of respect there for that franchise that these creators have, and I will commend them for that. You always have to give people respect where it's due, and I think this is one of the avenues where it is great you do. I think the other sense of continuity that I enjoy is, like I said, I've referred to the place that they stayed as the Great Valley, which is a term that is dubbed in the first movie. In the second movie, I believe, it's they dubbed the Mysterious Beyond, and that is a term that they use throughout the next 13 movies. It's the sense of specific continuity in words, in language. Because these dinosaurs don't have the language we have, they don't necessarily call each other. It's not a T-Rex. It's not a pterodactyl. It's not a triceratops. It is a three-horned. It is a flyer. It's a swooper. It's a long neck. It's sharp tooth. It's a stone horn. I like these sense of terminologies, these simple terms. And the dinosaur species is one thing, but even the way they describe stuff, like we have sky fire, which is whenever lightning strikes. We have the big circle and the night circle, which are the sun and the moon. We have the tree star, which is the leaves off of the trees that the herbivores eat for nutrients, but the fact that that is a terminology that they stick with, and not just the kids, it's also how the adults refer to a lot of the things, and we would have terminology that is introduced throughout the course of the series to describe different stuff, you know, white ground sparkles for the first snowfall, and it, you know, it's something that that one is actually created by the kids because it's not something that the adults had seen before or seen very often. You have a ground crawlers, there's even a song about that, I believe, which are like the, you know, bugs and insects on the ground. So I love the way that it uses language in a very kid-friendly way, but also very respectful of the characters and where they are at the time, because these are not things that these dinosaurs would have known. I mean, they could have named each other stuff, but you know, they're naming it based off of their descriptions and stuff like that. So I think that's a really cool bit of continuity and internal logic that the movies maintain. So kudos on them for that. Kudos on them for the continuity of language. Kudos on them for the continuity of world and characters. Where we are not going to give them kudos on, and it's something that I am super surprised by, is the amount of pure racism in this franchise. Like, I mean, honestly speaking, I guess it's not something you notice as a kid, but a lot of the characters in these movies are racist as hell, in the sense that they really don't like to interact with dinosaurs that are not their species or their kind. I think the easiest example would be in the original movie when you first meet Sari and she's talking about, like, her dad tells her never to play with long necks and sharp tooth. Like, sharp tooth makes sense. And this is actually something that her dad repeats in the second and third movie as well, I believe. And it is something that comes up from time to time. And then they would be introduced to new characters, and the initial thing is hatred or dislike or distrust of them because they are a different species or they don't necessarily understand it. I think for me the best example is Chomper. When we meet Chomper, you know, he's in the Great Valley, he's, you know, acclimated to Littlefoot and Sari and Petrie and Ducky's world and their environment. But when we meet him again, Littlefoot and them are on Chomper's territory, so they're in his world with his parents, and most of those dinosaurs are omnivores. T-Rexes are carnivores. So, you know, they eat different stuff, they act differently, and the movie is not subtle about that. Like, Littlefoot and his friends are afraid of meeting Chomper's parents. They don't like what he eats. They say it smells. And I honestly, some of that just rang true. It's like having some of your white friends come visit you and realizing that, like, oh, maybe that food you've grown up with or have eaten all your time isn't something they're accustomed to. But it's never really the reverse, in that, like, Chomper didn't have any issues with their food because they were the majority and that's what they fed him. But going to his area, it just felt so weird that it resonated in such a weird way with me. And, like, yeah, I feel it. I feel the disappointment. I feel the shock in that his friends won't even attempt to try the stuff he's offering. Like, yes, I get it. You don't want to force a vegetarian or a vegan to eat food. I think it's just the logic. It really dawned on me when Noodlefoot was like, it smells funny here. And I was just like, wow, that hurts. That stings so much. And yeah, it's just so utterly racist. I believe there's even a song about it in one of the movies, and I really wish I remembered which one it was. About it's the one with, like, the Tiniosaurus, which are the tiny dinosaurs, and Noodlefoot blames them again, subtle racism. And once he actually realizes that they're actual dinosaurs, like, everybody else in his town blames them and dislikes them just based off of sight and who they are. And again, if you're not a white person, you probably don't necessarily read some of the stuff that I read into it, but a lot of what they said, a lot of their actions are just from a point of privilege, a point of being in this. I mean, the Great Valley is essentially gated community, and it's very, you know, nebulous. There are even movies that deal with like people trying to come in to the Great Valley and being shunned because they're different, they're an outsider, they don't necessarily fit in with the culture. And yeah, it sometimes it's like it's hard not to see this as coded language for kids. And the logic doesn't end there. There is a, I think, the fourth movie where Littlefoot actually meets another Young Neck, a younger version, Young Neck, who you kind of know has like this flirty relationship with him. And that is something we'll get into in a second, because like there seems to be dynamics where there are characters who want to flirt and do stuff, but it kind of gets dropped because I guess they don't really want to introduce romantic elements too much. Though it is weird because Ciri's dad does get married, or yeah, because he gets married in the 13th movie and they have a kid in the 14th movie. So I guess the adults can have relationships, and it's weird that he's the only, whatever. But yeah, and the fourth movie, wow, there's so many of these. He meets another Long Neck, and she doesn't want to play with his friends because she doesn't trust him. Long Necks belong with Long Necks, three horns behind come with three horns. So there's even some degree of reverse discrimination in these franchises as well. So yeah, there you go. I'm just putting it out there. There is a lot of dinosaur racism in these movies. It is a surprising amount of dinosaur racism. Like, dinosaur racism and sharp-toothed attacks are the key backbone and pillars of the Land Before Time franchise, if I had to sum up 14 movies in as succinct a way as possible. So yeah, I mentioned before that the first movie is The Black Sheep. It's kind of different, and starting with the second one, it turns into a musical franchise. It turns into essentially kind of knockoff Disney movies. And let me tell you this, nothing has made me appreciate Disney's animated movies more than watching the Land Before Time franchise, because you realize how hard and difficult it is to actually make fun, compelling, catchy, and good songs sung by professional singers with great voices. Because there are a lot of songs in this franchise that I listened to while watching this movie, and I thought, why did they make this person sing this song? This does not work for their range. This does not make any sense. There's no rhyme or reason. It's just like, this person needs a song. We don't even care if this person has a singing voice. We're just going to give them a musical number. And I was just like, I don't know why you did this. And I will say, there may be a handful of songs that I enjoyed, but for the most part, they are like utterly forgettable. And they do this thing often where the songs are not even like with Disney. A lot of the songs tend to be related to the story or be related to how the character's feeling. Where a lot of these songs, it's like somebody talking, and then like you'll just hear like this musical interlude behind it. Like, okay, they're pumping it for a musical number, and then the person will start singing. And sometimes it's related to what's going on. Sometimes it just seems like they want to sing a song because they want to sing a song, and it doesn't always work for me. I think the very first song of the second movie where it turns into a musical is just kind of like a cover version of like, why can't we be friends, or we're friends, or something like that, where it's just like, oh, this is just kind of like a feel good happy moment, but it comes out of nowhere. And really, like for me, like I said, that was the moment it kind of kicked. I'm like, okay, the first movie, it's gonna be nothing like the rest of the franchise for me. I mentioned earlier with the, you know, it's tying this all together. I mentioned earlier about the continuity of characters, the continuity of language, the continu and the con you know, continuity of the story, and I mentioned the singing. I what does not have a continuity, and again, it kind of makes sense when you look at the fact that these films span almost 30 years, is the continuity of voice actors. The voice actors and actresses of this franchise change often. For instance, Sari is the only character in the original movie who keeps her voice actress beyond the first movie. Her voice actress, Candace Hudson, remains through the first four, and then that's transitioned out to Andy McCaff. Littlefoot, who's the main character, actually changes his voice actor several times. He has one in the original. He has a voice actor from 2 to 4. He gets a different one in 5. 6 through 9 has his voice act a new voice actor, but it's the person who sings his song in the fifth one. 10, new voice actor. 11, new voice actor. 12, new voice actor. 13, new voice actor. 14, new voice actor. Ducky, tragic story. I actually found out while While watching the series, one of my professors actually linked this to me while I was watching it on Facebook, that the original actress for Ducky's voice actually passed away before the release of the original movie. And that saying passed away is just sugarcoating it. They were murdered, and that was that. I mean, honestly, that was just really sad and depressing to hear, especially for such an upbeat character with such a unique voice. But yeah, so of course Ducky's replaced after the first movie with Heather Hogan, who again, like the first four movies seem to have a consistent voice cast, and then it changes after that. But Ducky does retain the same voice actress from movie 5 until the end. Petrie has the same voice actor from 2 to 14, so that's good on him. And then Spike has a voice actor, but it doesn't really make any sense because Spike, I think, speaks in two movies, and it's made such a big deal. So yeah, it is really weird, especially with Littlefoot. There is a movie in particular, I want to say it's 10, where he just sounds like, it's not even like somebody trying to mimic his older voice, he just sounds older, and then he kind of transitions back to his younger sounding voice in the next movie. So I thought that was really weird. And on that same note, there is a movie, I believe it's The Invasion of the Tiniosaurus, which is movie 11, where Littlefoot is made fun of for being tiny, short, small for his size, which again I thought was weird because the characters don't seem to have aged from the first movie. Like, we know seasons have happened, we know that thing, but they all seem to still roughly be the same age they were in the first movie. So he's still a kid, but like even his grandparents mentioned that he's tiny for his age. So I thought that was a really weird plot point, that only happens in that movie. And it only happens, I guess, because he finds people smaller than he is. But I thought that was a really odd plot point. It's one of the ones where, like, it's, they are kind of shaming him. So that is a weird thing to do. I guess the other thing, while we're on voice actors and the voice actresses, is like this movie somehow or another actually does pull in some decent name talent. Like Littlefoot's father is played by Kiefer Sutherland in his original appearance. He has a different voice actor when he returns, but and this is at the peak of 24. This would have been, I think, this is like 2002, 2003. So this is like season 3 or 4 of 24. So like this is back when he was winning his daytime Emmys for his performance on the show. The most recent movie, 14, had Reba McEntire in a role, and she got to sing, because Reba has a fantastic voice. So yeah, it's interesting the type of characters, the quality of voice actors they get to pull in for these roles, these one-off roles. And I'm happy. Again, it kind of shows that I think this franchise does have a. This franchise does have a love for its characters and its audience. It's never really cheapened out on the quality of the voices or the animation. I mean, I will say something about the quality of the singing and the songs, but I mean, it's a kids' movie, so maybe they enjoy it. But yeah, I think they do a really good job with that overall. I know. I'm being super positive, and I don't really have much to say about the movies, I guess, but. I guess my takeaway from this experiment is that this is a kids franchise, and it is not necessarily something that a 35-year-old man needed to watch to understand that. But I'm happy that I have watched it. I'm happy that I have the knowledge of it. I never want to see any of these movies again, and that is just what it is. But that happens. I appreciate it on the same level that I kind of appreciate Air Bud. They're not for me, but they are decent movies for kids. And I've spoken to a lot of people during this experiment who, especially parents, who have said that it's helped them teach their kids important lessons about friendship, about discrimination, about bullying, about shaming. It's helped them bond. It's helped them with kids who love dinosaurs, because you got constant new content for almost 20 years out of this. It's helped them in many ways. It's a franchise that I think is not on the same level as a lot of classic Disney movies, but as a kid of the 80s, it is one of those movies that I saw constantly as a kid because they showed it in school during the elementary school recess in the winter when we couldn't go outside. And I'm happy to kind of have the complete picture now. I'm almost certain, I mean, even now after recording this, after my experiment is I couldn't really tell you a lot of these movies apart. I could tell you vaguely what happened in some of them. I can tell you know, like if the one was about the special fruit that bears like once a year on the trees. I could tell you one is about finding Littlefoot's dad in a volcano. I could tell you one is about Peach learning how to fly. One has a sleepwalker. So there are plot elements, there are certain characters who I could tell you exist and it happens. I couldn't, if you asked me what was movie five, I probably couldn't even tell you the name of it, let alone what happens in it. And I think that is what's going to happen over time, is that those memories are just going to fade, and it's going to be like this vague thing, this vague but fun thing that I did during my quarantine. Because, I mean, ultimately, it is a new piece of knowledge. It is something that I did not know going into this whole pandemic era of 2020 that I do know. And I feel some way about it. I mean, I do feel that it's going to be funny that my reputation online on certain channels is going to be that this guy who watches bad movies and binge watch 14 Land Before Time movies. But, I mean, I guess it's better than being known or not known for something, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, I do not recommend doing this. If you have any questions or comments, I will be following this up. I do want to do, again, I'm going to try to vaguely remember what the movies are. I'm going to try to wiki them and put my memory together. I do want to do a countdown of like the top seven best movies in the franchise, and I will easily tell you number one is the best, and I think number 13 might be the worst movie for me. And then like there's a period of time where diminishing returns, but I do, for instance, I think 3 is better than 2 and stuff like that. So I'll try to piece those together. And I also do want to do like a top 7 rankings of the song. So hopefully I get that out there as well. So look forward to that. But until then, thank you for listening to this. If you made it to the end, this has been a very, very special episode of Nerds on the Rocks, the Land Before Time episode. If you are so inclined, if you want to punish yourself, the first 13 movies are available on the Starz app as of this recording, and the 14th movie is available for free on the recently launched Peacock app. There are a lot of streaming apps out there, so, you know, make the best of them if you can, especially the free ones. And, I mean, maybe I'll be back with you soon, because I am currently in the middle of marathoning the original 1987's Ninja Turtles cartoon, and that has had a lot of thoughts pop up in my head as well. But for myself, who I just realized 30 some odd minutes and I had never introduced, this is Earl. I am saying, you know, for all of you dinosaur lovers out there, we're gonna venture to the land before time. Have a good one, and thank you again.